And the book of Daniel falls into two parts. There's chapters 1 to 6, which is a historical narrative, sort of chronological, it all follows. And then there's chapters 7 to 12, and they are apocalyptic. Though sometimes I wonder if it's more helpful to think of it not so much as apocalyptic, but as eternal, eternal truth. These chapters are dreams and accounts that point to the eternal reality. And their purpose, whether here in Daniel, or in Revelation, or elsewhere in the Bible, the purpose of apocalyptic is to encourage. It's to encourage and inspire. To encourage and inspire Jews in exile in Babylon. To encourage and inspire early Christians persecuted, and John in exile in Patmos. And to encourage and inspire our brothers and sisters round the world who suffer for their faith. You see, the point of apocalyptic literature is to remind us that God is over all, and ultimately God wins. Whatever your circumstances now, God wins. Apocalyptic stories aren't there for us to crystal ball and speculate about the future. In fact, Jesus warns us very sternly against that. We won't know the day or the hour. Apocalyptic stories are there to encourage us. And the other thing about apocalyptic literature is that if you try to use it to crystal ball, if you try to use it to speculate, it becomes really quite obscure and we don't know what to do with it, and it becomes awkward. And then it becomes like the naughty child of theology. So we put it on the naughty step because we don't know what to do with it. Whereas if we actually realise that it's there to encourage, that it fits together with the rest of the Bible, and it does, then it makes sense. And that's one of the reasons I changed the second reading. The second reading today was originally Revelation. But actually, when you read Daniel and then read John, 1 John, it fits together. And you can do that with a whole lot of the other apocalyptic literature. It is an intrinsic part of the Bible. We just need to read it, meditate on it, and understand. If we actually understand, it does fit together. So chapters 1 to 6, historical narrative. Chapters 7 to 12, apocalyptic or eternal. Now that we've got that background, let's turn to Daniel 7. It's an incredible passage about a very troubling dream that Daniel had, and I'm not surprised that he was troubled by it. But I'm not sure that we really understand just how troubling or why he was troubled by it. So that's the first question I'd like you to think about it. Why was this dream so troubling to Daniel? And this is an incredible chapter. There is so much in it. It's like going into the theological equivalent of a sweetie shop. You're not quite sure which jar to open, which sweets to have. There are so many different questions that are raised about the four beasts, about the ten horns, about the boastful little horn, about the incredible heavenly imagery, about the Ancient of Days, about the one like a son of man, about the destruction of the beasts, about the interpretation, and even what is missed out of the interpretation. And I could go on and on. But I'm not going to cover all of these. These are sermons for another day, or perhaps questions over your Sunday lunch, or perhaps questions for you to discuss in your home groups. Today, we're going for the bullseye, the bit in the middle. Who is this one like a son of man? Who is it? And we're going to continually revisit that question and reframe it as we go in this journey together. Who is this that Daniel sees? And did Daniel understand it? Did he get it? And do we understand it? Do we get it? You might like to open your Bibles again and return to Daniel 7. And we're just going to look at verses 9 and 10, just as a bit of background. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow, and the hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming like fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Daniel is peering into the throne room of heaven. The magnificent presence of God is described in incredible language, which still doesn't convey the full sense of majesty and awe and wonder. This is unsullied holiness. The very presence of the Most High God. God himself, surrounded by the supreme court of the universe that makes the splendor of all the earthly courts and kingdoms pale into insignificance. And then following that description, there's some more prophecy about the little horn. But what happens next is the mind-blowing part of this chapter. In fact, it's the mind-blowing part of the whole book. If you thought that other stories like Daniel in the Lion's Den, or the writing on the wall, or the fiery furnace were amazing, well, yes, they are. But this tops them all, if you get it. So let's reread verses 13 and 14. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Who is this? Do you understand? Do you think you understand? Who or what is Daniel describing? Well, over the years, people have come up with three possibilities, three suggestions. And you might like to remember these because we'll come back to them later. And the first is, it's an angel. This was an idea that was popular in the Middle Ages, perhaps not so much now. The second suggestion is that it's the nation of Israel. And the third is a high priestly Messiah. Who do you think this is? Well, let's unpack this. But as we do, I'd like you to imagine that you are Daniel, a 6th century BC Jew in exile in a foreign land, faithfully worshipping Yahweh. So we have the heavenly throne room that's just been described, the Ancient of Days. And then this one like a son of man. And this is an expression that does appear elsewhere in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. But in the Old Testament, if you're interested in statistics, it appears around 100 times. And it's often used to denote humanity. And often it's the frailty and temporalness of humanity, over against, contrasted with, the absolute holiness of God and the eternity of God. But the particular expression used here is an Aramaic one, and it's Bar Enosh. And in this Babylonian context that Daniel is living in, it has the meaning of heir, of successor, of royal successor, of someone of the highest position. So this isn't about humanity. This isn't a generic term to describe humanity. This is about a son of royalty, someone of the highest position. So that's our very first clue. A royal son. What happens next? He's coming on the clouds of heaven. Who rides the clouds of heaven? Well, in Deuteronomy 33, when Moses is blessing the tribes, he says, "There is no one like the God of Jeshurun who rides across the heavens to help you and on the clouds in his majesty." And in the Psalms, there are various descriptions of God riding the clouds. Psalm 104, God makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. It's God who rides the clouds. And do you think of the clouds as big, fluffy balls of water vapour? Or are they something more majestic, more glorious, reflecting the very presence, the Shekinah of God? Sometimes I wonder if the problem of this age is not so much our rationalistic outlook and our questioning as our lack of imagination. Do you really think God rides the clouds like some Victorian cherub on a fluffy ball of white cotton wool? Or does he really ride in his glory? So here, this Son of Man rides the very same clouds that God rides. And what does that signify? If you rode in the state coach along with the Queen, what would it mean? Or if you were on Air Force One along with the President of the USA, what would that mean? It would mean that in some way you were close. You had a close relationship. This person, this figure, is in close relationship with God. Very close. And then he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. Whoa, just stop right there. What did he do? He approached the very presence, the majestic presence of God. Remember, Daniel is in Babylon. The temple with the Holy of Holies, which the high priest could only enter once a year, had been destroyed. Yet here, Daniel sees someone entering the very presence of God in a priestly way, with impunity. This royal son, who's very close to God, also has the kind of access reserved for the high priest once a year. This is a priest, but even higher than the high priest. The imagery here is of the priest of all priests, the highest priest. One who has unlimited access to the very presence of God. And then he was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. Who gave it? The Ancient of Days. God himself bestowed authority, glory, and sovereign power on this person. Glory that's an attribute of God. Glory that is described poetically in the Psalms and described in wonder and awe by the prophets. Glory that Isaiah 42:8 tells us God gives to no other. Yet, God bestows it on this royal son, this highest priest, this one who's very close to him. Who is this? All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. Worshipped him? Worshipped him. What's the first commandment? It's in Exodus 20 and it's in the back wall there. You shall worship only God. You have no other gods. It's emphatic. It's unambiguous. Yet God not only bestows authority, glory and sovereign power, he allows worship of this figure by people of all nations. This royal son, close to God, in relation to God, highest priest with glory and sovereign power, is now acknowledged as God. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So in amongst all those earthly kingdoms that were described earlier, earthly kingdoms that come and go, there's an everlasting kingdom that will not be overcome. A kingdom that is shaped by eternity and the values of eternity. And the figure described here is the King. A royal son in close relationship to God, highest priest with God's authority and glory, worshipped as God and is King. Son, priest, God and King. Who is this? Do you see? Do you get it? Do you understand? What were those three suggestions we looked at earlier? Can you remember the three suggestions about who this figure might be? Anyone? The first one?
Angel.
Yeah, an angel. Do you think it's an angel? Nope. Doesn't fit by a long way. For a start, we don't worship angels. What about the second one? What was the second suggestion? Israel, yeah. Does that fit? Nope, that doesn't fit by a long way either. And what was the third one? A high priestly Messiah. I heard someone whispering it. A high priestly Messiah. Yeah, we're getting closer now. But it all depends on what you expect the Messiah to be. A political, theological revolutionary to restore the fortunes of the nation. To restore the Davidic kingdom. Or God incarnate, bringing in his reign and rule. Remember I asked you at the beginning to think about why the dream was so troubling. Have you worked it out yet? The dream is troubling, not just because of the fantastical imagery of the four beasts or the incredible imagery of heaven. Daniel has been faithful to Yahweh through all circumstances. He's faithfully and prayerfully worshipped God and not any of the Babylonian or Persian deities. He's been faithful even to the point of death. Yet he sees this figure, one like a son of man, assume the very mantle of deity. This is alien to Daniel. He couldn't and wouldn't make it up. Spoiler alert. If you haven't worked it out already, it's Jesus that Daniel sees. Jesus in his glory. And Daniel has been given an insight into the Trinitarian nature of God. But does he get it? No. No, I don't think he does. And that's one of the reasons it's so troubling. But he faithfully recounted it. He faithfully wrote it down so that those who came after might read, might interpret, and might perhaps understand. And it didn't make sense until 600 years later in the time of Jesus. But if you struggle to get it, you're actually in good company, because the disciples, the early followers of Jesus, they didn't get it at first either. Yes, they occasionally showed glimpses of understanding, such as Peter's confession that Jesus is the Christ. But that was a momentary blip. Their view was largely tainted by their desire of a political, theological, revolutionary figure. They wanted a political Messiah to overthrow the Romans and restore the fortunes of Israel. And even though they walked with Jesus and listened to him, they didn't really understand the sonship. They didn't really understand the priestliness. They didn't really understand the glory, authority, and sovereign power that God had bestowed on Jesus. And they didn't understand his kingship or the everlasting kingdom. It wasn't until after the cross, after the resurrection, and even Pentecost, that it began to fall into place. But once they got it, it fired them up. It fired up the early church. And we see that powerfully. You see it powerfully in the recounting in the Gospels. You see it powerfully in Acts. You see it powerfully in Paul's letters. The early followers got that Jesus wasn't just a man. Wasn't just some prophet. Wasn't just some vague insurance policy to get us into heaven. Jesus, who walked among us, is the Son of God. Jesus, who walked among us, is the highest priest, mediating for us, giving himself for us, and giving us access to God. Jesus is God and worthy of worship. And Jesus is King, ruler of an everlasting kingdom, King of kings. How often do we see something or read something and think that we understand it, but we don't really? How often does our attitude or our perspective or expectations or even our desires and motivations get in the way of our understanding of who Jesus really is? Even in church, sometimes we try to wrap the gospel up in a formula. Believe this, say that prayer. But the good news is about the Son who gives us access, the one who is God and invites us into God's kingdom. It's about a relationship with one who sits with God. And it can't be contained in a neat formula, because at the centre is a person. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the highest priest, God incarnate, the King of kings. And this is the stuff that the Bible reveals. And it becomes clearer to us as we pray, as we spend time in the Word, as we meditate on the Word, as we faithfully seek God, like Daniel did. And if we get it, if we get just a glimpse of what Daniel saw and what the early church realised, it will change our outlook, our values, and what we live for. The invitation to us is to live with and for the King of Kings himself, the Son, High Priest, God and King. So if you're living with some binary view of Jesus as a man and God is transcendent and mysterious. And you can't quite work out how they come together. Then take this time as we journey towards Advent to rediscover Jesus. Not just Jesus the baby, or even Jesus the man, but Jesus the Son of God, our High Priest, God and King. And if you don't know Jesus, or you're discovering him anew, then that's one of the reasons we meet together as church. To encourage one another, to share in support, to share our discoveries, to pray together. And if you are discovering anew, or even discovering for the first time, then please don't leave here today without taking the opportunity to talk to someone. Myself, or Simon, or Jeremy, or any one of the team. We don't know everything. We're still learning ourselves. We're still in the journey. And the journey of preparing for this sermon has been an amazing one, which has been refreshing for me. But we'd love to share the excitement of the journey with Jesus with you. So don't leave today without taking that opportunity of finding out more about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, our great High Priest, God, and the King of Kings. Amen.